Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. For many, summer vacation is winding down, and you may have already worked your way through your list of summer reads. But don't despair. There's still time to squeeze in a few more books, and joining me now with some ideas to see you through the last gasp of summer is Jenny Roan. She's a cell biologist at University College London, a novelist, and editor of the LabLit.com web magazine. Jenny, always good to talk with you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Heather. It's great to be back.
All right. So the website that you edit, LabLit.com, is dedicated to this specific genre that I think maybe you actually invented the name for, LabLit, which is novels in which at least one main character is a scientist and somehow their research features into the story. But I want to start with a book that also has not just scientists, but trees as main characters. And this is The Overstory by Richard Powers. Tell us about that one.
Well, this is a fantastic novel. If you've not read it yet, you really have to. And summer is a great time to sink into it because, like a very large tree, it's got a massive circumference and lots of concentric rings. And it's really hard to describe this plot. It's an interlocking story of nine central characters, which doesn't include the trees. The trees are definitely a tenth, probably the protagonist, the main character. It spans from 1800s New York all the way to the present day. It is all about trees, how trees are in trouble, how humans are trying to save the trees. There's a lot of tree rights activists, loads of tree huggers. It's a wonderful story in that it puts you into the mind of these environmental activists. And you might think, oh God, these people, they destroy property and they're dangerous. But once you read this book, you start to realize, it's really important to save the trees. And entwined with the trees' fate is our own planets. So it's a wonderful way to sort of wake yourself up, even if you're already woke about the environment. I mean, I thought I was, but after reading this, I really thought, gosh, I got to go out and hug a tree.
And in addition to getting us into the minds of environmental activists, you also say this book highlights the hidden world of tree-to-tree communication, and it's actually science-based. It's not making up, that trees are actually saying words to each other, but actually talking about the real-world ways in which trees can communicate with each other.
It is fascinating, and I knew nothing about this. So first of all, there are these airborne pheromones where if one tree is attacked by a predator, it can set off these scents that other trees can detect, and they can mobilize their defenses, which is pretty amazing. And then underground, there is this massive network of roots and fungi, the sort of symbiotic fungi, and through those root systems, there's a lot of communication going on. And it's not just sustaining the trees, it's sustaining the entire forest. So when people plant you cut down virgin forest and you plant some pine trees, it's not the same thing. You've destroyed the sort of fundamental firmament that you need to have a healthy forest and a healthy planet. I knew nothing about this. I really found that fascinating.
Well, Jenny, sticking with the ecological theme, you're recommending a book that's the debut novel by an award-winning Norwegian author, Maya Lund. And the book is The History of Bees. What makes that stand out from, quite frankly, the many books about bees that we've seen in recent years?
Bee lit, yes. Well, this is a lovely story because it's quite literary. It's very beautifully written. And it spans, again, a very large period of time. We have England in the 1850s, the United States in the early 21st century, and China in 2098. So there's a little bit of science fiction in this. The lab lit component comes with the British part of the story where William is a beekeeper and a scientist, and he's trying to build a new kind of beehive that will make his name. But it's all about bees. The United States theme in the near present day is a beekeeper who's dealing with colony collapse, which is, of course, a serious problem these days. And the Chinese 2019 thread is the most fascinating. This is the science fiction thread. It's a world where bees no longer exist, and people have to hand pollinate all the food to stay alive. So, like, meticulously hand pollinate things with little paintbrushes, and China is a sort of like a factory of just people who are raised to climb trees and pollinate them. And it's a really powerful narrative because you realize just how important bees are. I mean, we all know this, but to see it depicted in this lovely story, it's a very, very sad story, actually. The whole thing is a little bit of a downer, all three timelines. But you really get a sense of how important, again, just like in the overstory, how important the planet is and how intertwined we all are. And you lose one thing and you can lose everything. What sets it apart is the way it's done it. It's this period drama and then the present-day drama and this future sort of dystopian fiction. It really works together, and it chops and changes between these three narratives, but not in a way that jars. It just flows, and it's just a wonderful story. And I think it's maybe not a happy beach read, but it's definitely worth a look.
Okay, Jenny Roan, let's get on to some of the more classic beach reads, less dystopian. I mean, especially with the name of this next book, Happiness by Aminata Forna. It's like a love story with maybe a light dose of urban fox research thrown in there somewhere.
Yes, this is an interesting little book. It's very short. It's set in present-day London, and two strangers literally collide on Waterloo Bridge. Attila, who's a really engaging character, he's a psychiatrist from Ghana, and Jean, who's an American studying urban foxes. And they have this chance encounter, and they keep running into each other, which is something I must say does happen in London. This has happened to me several times. You can meet somebody in a city of 8 million people, and you might run into them again the next day. And all sorts of strange connections occur. There's a lost child subplot, and everybody bands together in the underworld, sort of London's underworld, to try to find this lost child. And you've got parking attendants. You've got the mimes who are working South Bank, you know, dressed up like a silver robot, you know, the ones who don't move, and people try to make them move. All these people who are sort of drawn together, and because they're from Ghana, they're all these immigrants from Ghana, and Attila is from Ghana, and he's sort of mobilizing this amazing underworld of people. And Jean, the scientist, is drawn into this world. It's really lovely. It's a really nice depiction of what happens when people get together and coexist in a very large city.
And maybe one of those examples where the fact that the main character, or I guess you could say both a psychiatrist and a fox researcher, both are scientists, is almost a little bit superfluous. Just puts scientists into the realm of other normal people, right? Anybody could be the main character in these stories.
Yeah, this is Lab Lit Light, what I call it. It's kind of the Ross from Friends characters, where it doesn't matter that, you know, Ross from Friends was a scientist. It doesn't matter. You never hear about it. It's true that the science is very light here. You do learn a little bit about urban foxes. Made me hate them less. We've got them all over our back garden, and they bug me. But I felt a bit of sympathy for these poor foxes, and that was interesting. But no, it's not about science. It's about human connection. But I like the Lab Lit Light stories that just have a touch, a whiff of science, just to draw you into a new engaging world. I think that's absolutely fine with me.
Another in the romance vein of things, which I just love this title, Love and Other Dangerous Chemicals by Anthony Capella. Sounds like a totally classic beach read.
This is a complete chick lit, despite the fact that it's written by a man. It is absolutely utterly ridiculous. It features a really nerdy male scientist called Stephen Fisher, who's a brilliant biochemist with absolutely no social skills, who studies the female orgasm. That's his specialty subject.
So we get a little bit of sex science as well as maybe just the sex scenes in the story.
There's lots of sex science. I think it's a little bit based on Masters and Johnson, the classic researchers who studied the female orgasm. And he's invented this Viagra-like pill for women, and now he just needs to have subjects to test it on. It's hilarious. I mean, he tested on Ukrainian prostitutes who like to, they only come when it's raining. They come in because they, you know, it's something to do, and they get money for it. And he ends up with this woman called Annie, who's orgasmically challenged. And she's an art student. She studies the Victorian semicolon. And she volunteers to be part of the study. One thing leads to another. And it's ridiculous. The science is absolutely crazy. But the funny thing is, it's told from the point of view of Fisher, the nerdy scientist. And he does really think like a scientist. You see in detail the problems he's having with his experiments. His controls aren't working. He's getting pressure from his head of department, who just wants money. He's being funded by a biotech company who's really just wants him to get on with it and doesn't want to hear about the fact that Annie is not conforming to the rest of his subjects and isn't being helped by this Viagra pill. It's funny. It's a laugh out loud funny book that's completely over the top. And if you don't take it too seriously, you'll really like it. We discussed this book last night at my Lab Lit book group, and the scientists in the group could totally forgive the sort of ludicrous science, but what they didn't like was the ethical questions it raised. You know, he was sort of falling in love with this subject, and he was giving her the wrong pills without telling anyone. And, you know, it's really ethically dubious, but despite this, it was a very good read.
All right, last but not least, Unsheltered by Barbara Kingsolver. Obviously not new right now, out in paperback this year, and not Kingsolver's first time showing up on a Lab Lit list by any means. She's kind of a veteran of writing about scientists. So tell us about Unsheltered.
Well, Kingsolver is one of my all-time favorite authors, and I just completely look forward to everything she writes. And when she chooses to write Lab Lit, I'm just thrilled. This is an interesting story. Yet again, we seem to have a theme here. It's several timelines. It's spanning between 1871 and 2016 in the same place, which is Vinland, New Jersey, or Vineland, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one that would be.
It does exist. It's in New Jersey. It was founded as a utopian alcohol-free society of progressive thinking. Who knew? And it deals with a young Charles Darwin advocate comes to town to be this new science teacher. But nobody there. It's a sort of a religious society. Nobody wants to hear it. He lives next door to this biologist, or I would call her a biologist. She's more like an amateur naturalist. Her name is Mary Treat. And she's a really, really intelligent woman. She does all her own observations. The first time he sees her, I think she's on her stomach looking at ants in her back garden. And she corresponds with Charles Darwin and all these famous people, and they end up having a bit of a fling. It's a lovely story. And in the present day, it's the people who live in the same house. So they've inherited this house that these people lived in back in 1871. And it's kind of discovering the story of the people who used to live there. And it's a sort of a real family story. So the modern tale is more about Willa Knox, who's the woman who lives there, and her house is falling apart and her world is falling apart. And it's how her family sort of knits it all back together. And she's sort of investigating the story of this Mary Treat, the scientist who used to live next door. Now, when I got to the end of the book, I discovered in the afterword that this is all completely true. So there was a Mary Treat. She did correspond with Darwin. There was a town called Vinland that was a utopian society. It all pretty much happened as depicted in the story, except for the love story and the science teacher were invented just for narrative flair. But everything else was real. And I thought, how fantastic. And Barbara Kingsolver says in her afterword, she really wants people to know more about this woman, Mary Treat, because she really was, in her day, quite a well-known naturalist. Nobody's ever heard of her. I've never heard of her.
Certainly I hadn't either, yeah.
And I think that fiction is really, really good. It's really good at doing that. So if you think about like the film Hidden Figures and how it illuminated this world of black mathematicians at NASA, you know, if it hadn't been for that film, many people still wouldn't know about those women. So I think fiction is an amazing stealth medium for sort of bigging up these historic women who have been forgotten.
And Barbara Kingsolver always does a fabulous job of, as you say, laying out exactly what in her stories is fact and what is fiction.
Yes. Some people really get bothered about that sort of thing. I don't really care. I just like to take it in as a work of art. But it's true, a lot of people go straight to Wikipedia after reading some historical Lab Lit novels because they desperately want to know what's true and what isn't. I'm a little bit more easy about it. But it was quite interesting knowing that she was a real person. And I kind of hope someone will sort of maybe publish her correspondence or write a biography. But, you know, you don't need to read a biography. You can just read this novel.
Jenny Roan is a cell biologist at University College London and editor of LabLit.com. Jenny, thanks for all the recommendations.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We want to hear what you've been reading. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know and then join us back here next week for more Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.